Welcome back to Ghosts of Arlington, and thank you for joining me for episode 90, The Spymaster Who Created Modern American Espionage, part 1. Two weeks ago, we wrapped up the story of Marine Colonel Peter Ortiz, the most highly decorated member of the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, the precursor to today's Central Intelligence Agency. Now I would like to go back a little farther and talk about William Donovan, the mastermind behind the OSS and the father of modern American espionage. A man often painted with broad black and white strokes by his supporters and his detractors, but whose real life had many shades of gray. William Joseph Donovan, called Will by his friends and family, was born on January 1, 1883 in Buffalo, New York. His grandparents, Timothy and Mary O'Donovan, had immigrated from County Cork, Ireland as newlyweds. They dropped the O from their surname and integrated well into U.S. society while having 10 children like the good Irish Catholics they were. Donovan's father, also named Tim but called Young Tim to distinguish him from his father, Big Tim, became a well-respected member of the community and followed his parents' example, moving from the shanty town side of Buffalo, uptown, not long after he was married. Donovan was greatly influenced by his parents and extended family. From young Tim's side, he inherited toughness, duty, and honor to country and clan. From his mother Anna's side of the family, he learned style, etiquette, and the dreams of poets, all traits which would serve him well later in life. Donovan adored his mother and tried to control his violent temper for her sake. Despite that, there was always an intensity to Anna's oldest child. Both parents insisted that all of their children, and they had 5 that survived beyond infancy, would receive an education, an opportunity that Anna had enjoyed as a child, and an opportunity that had been afforded to young Tim, but one on which he had turned his back, something he regretted by the time he had children of his own, and something he was trying to rectify by amassing a large personal library. A library that was not only for him to catch up, but also for his children to get ahead. Donovan was an erratic student. His spelling grades were poor, something I can commiserate with. He barely scraped by in geography, but the nuns who taught him found Donovan particularly well-read for a child his age, with an almost insatiable appetite for books. He was also not shy about standing in front of his class and reading stories or orations. At 13, he enrolled in a secondary school that stressed public speaking, debate, and athletics. He thrived. He acted in school plays, won a gold medal for an oration titled Independence Forever, and earned a reputation as a scrappy and fierce football player. His grades even improved a little. In Irish Catholic families at that time, it was assumed that one son would enter the priesthood. Young Tim and Anna never hinted at this notion with their boys, but Donovan always assumed that he would become a priest. To that end, he began taking courses at Niagara University, a Catholic college and seminary, during his final few years of high school, but it didn't take Donovan long to dissuade himself of a religious calling. Father William Egan, a professor at the university who became one of Donovan's religious mentors, gently advised him that he did not seem cut out for the cloth. As he finished high school, Father Egan encouraged Donovan to pursue a career in law and wrote him a glowing recommendation that helped him gain admittance to Columbia College in New York City in 1903, despite his less-than-stellar academic record. Donovan remained an average student but loved campus life. He continued to win awards for his oratory and added crew and cross-country to his sports repertoire. By his senior year, his position as a football quarterback elevated him to near-hero status among his peers, at least until a Princeton linebacker ended his career with a hard hit halfway through the season. In the senior yearbook, his classmates voted him most modest and one of the most handsome. After graduating with a Bachelor of Arts degree, he immediately enrolled in Columbia Law School, which he completed in 2 years. It was during this time that he became a serious student. He caught the attention of Harlan Stone, a highly respected New York lawyer and legal professor. Donovan now had a well-placed mentor who, over the years, would become a close friend. And though they had no real interaction because they had next to nothing in common, one of Donovan's Columbia classmates was future President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who may or may not play a more important role in Donovan's later life. Oh man, I am getting good at this foreshadowing thing. Donovan returned to Buffalo after law school, worried that he had rushed through his time at university and wasn't truly educated. He mulled over entering politics, but that horrified friends and family, who convinced him that it would be a waste of a good education. After a year of hemming and hawing, Bill Donovan, only his family still called him Will, joined the venerable Love and Keating law firm. 2 years later, he partnered with Bradley Goodyear, a Columbia classmate from a prominent Buffalo family, and opened his own legal practice. 3 years after that, Donovan and Goodyear merged with Buffalo's most connected lawyer, John Lord O'Brien, who had advised President William Howard Taft and who would have the ear of future presidents on intelligence and defense matters. With the help of O'Brien and Goodyear, Donovan quickly climbed Buffalo's society ladder. In the spring of 1912, when he was 29 years old, Donovan and a group of like-minded young professionals, most of whom belonged to the same social clubs and organizations as Donovan, and looking for diversion, got authorization to form their own National Guard cavalry troop, designated Troop I. It started out as more of a drill, riding, and camping club for well-to-do city boys who had never marched in a line, ridden a horse, or slept outside. The troop was soon dubbed the Silk Stocking Boys by those mocking them, and even Donovan, who came from the most humble background in the troop, had to admit his colleagues needed a lot of work if the unit was going to be taken seriously. Ignoring the mocking of others, the group drilled every Friday night and referred to themselves as the businessmen's troop. They wrote their own bylaws and elected their own officers. Donovan was elected troop captain and took his new command seriously. In addition to his weekly drill duties, he devoured several books on military strategy and began attending Army combat classes twice a week. Within 4 years, Troop I became a well-trained unit with 100 cavalrymen in uniform and another 36 hopefuls fully trained and on a waiting list in case a slot opened up. As Donovan's social and professional stock rose, the once voted most handsome at Columbia attracted a lot of attention from Buffalo's most eligible bachelorettes, as well as from some he had known in New York City, who were still just a train ride away. After many high-profile flings, Donovan began a serious relationship with Ruth Runze, the heiress to a multi-million-dollar real estate fortune. Ruth's widowed mother disapproved of Donovan's humble origins despite his now impressive bank account, and she was also aware of the gossip, which turned out to be true, that he was not completely faithful during his courtship with her daughter. For her part, Ruth was an independent, free-thinking suffragette who also heard rumors of infidelity. She gave Donovan an ultimatum, and he chose Ruth, forswearing all other suitors. The couple was married in a small ceremony on July 15, 1914, at Ruth's family mansion. The intimate nature of this ceremony likely reflected Ruth's mother's disapproval, but Donovan quickly won over his mother-in-law and became her personal attorney for financial matters. However, he also remained a flirt. In July 1915, Ruth gave birth to their first child, a son named David. In early 1916, when David was just 6 months old and with World War I raging on the continent, Donovan traveled to Europe as a representative of the Rockefeller Foundation, trying to convince warring Germany and Great Britain to allow the foundation to ship $1 million worth of food and clothing to famine-plagued Belgium, Serbia, and Poland. In his absence, Ruth found it difficult to balance the duties of a single new first-time mother and the duties of managing an upper-class household where, in her words, appliances were constantly breaking down. By June, she was anxiously awaiting her husband's return. David was almost a year old and Donovan had been away for half of the young child's life. But world events had other plans. In late June, Donovan received a State Department cable. Troop I had been ordered to the Texas border to join General Blackjack Pershing's Expeditionary Army hunting Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa and his bandidos, who had begun attacking American citizens in cross-border raids. Donovan caught the first steamer ship back to the States and reported directly to Troop I in McAllen, a border town at the southern tip of Texas, just north of the Rio Grande River. When he arrived, he was promoted to major and began relentlessly drilling his troops to prepare them for battle, though they ended up fighting the elements more than the Mexicans. As the summer turned to fall and the fall turned to winter, Ruth's letters to Donovan became more and more melancholic, and in a Hall of Fame case of failing to read the room, he threatened to stop writing his wife if she did not start writing him cheerful love letters. By this time, Ruth's depression was also making her physically ill. I know that I am far from the most attentive husband, but I think that even Mrs. Ghosts of Arlington would agree that I've never been that oblivious. Troop I finally returned home in March 1917. Donovan had been gone for more than a year, but only returned to Buffalo long enough to leave Ruth pregnant again before his career and world events intervened once more. By now, it was apparent that the United States would not be able to stay out of World War I indefinitely, so Donovan set off to join the 69th Irish Regiment, based in New York City, and train for the war in Europe. Part of the regiment traced its lineage back to the American Revolution, and another part fought in some of the most important battles in the Civil War as part of the Army of the Potomac. More than 3,000 of New York's finest Irish sons now filled the 69th's ranks, and they wanted Irish-American officers to lead them, especially the regiment's chaplain, Father Francis Duffy. Duffy had recruited Donovan to command the regiment's 1st Battalion and envisioned him commanding the entire outfit someday. Donovan liked that kind of thinking and also agreed that he was suited for higher command. In August, the 69th moved to Long Island to train, was redesignated the 165th, and was made part of the 42nd Infantry Division. It also received an up-and-coming officer as its chief of staff, Major Douglas MacArthur. Yes, that Douglas MacArthur. You may remember when MacArthur first showed up in the podcast, all the way back in episode 10, at the head of a force being used to break up the Bonus Army Veterans Group that marched on Washington, D.C. after World War I to try to get the U.S. government to make good on financial payment promises for wartime service to alleviate the economic hardships of the Great Depression. Anyway, like he had with Troop I in Texas, Donovan drilled his battalion hard. He wanted to give them the best chance of surviving trench warfare. His harsh leadership made him an unpopular but respected commander. "I hate Donovan's guts, but I would go anywhere with him," one bruised but loyal soldier said, a sentiment echoed by many in 1st Battalion. On August 13th, Ruth delivered a baby girl. Donovan missed his family and arranged for them to come and stay with him for the remainder of the unit's training in Long Island. Father Duffy baptized baby Patricia with water from his canteen, and she was officially designated the daughter of the regiment. The next month and a half were some of the happiest of Donovan's marriage. Bill delighted in seeing Ruth come out of her depression and enjoyed being a father to little David and Patricia. And they were around to celebrate with him when he was promoted to lieutenant colonel, a reward for being one of the best battalion commanders in the division. The family's reunion came to an end in late October as the 165th boarded a troop transport for France. Donovan did not expect to make it out of the war alive, and neither Donovan nor Ruth knew that this was the last time they would truly be husband and wife. After arriving in France, Donovan continued to rigorously drill his battalion. One day, the 35-year-old led his much younger soldiers through a 3-mile-long obstacle course with full packs. He led his troops over walls, under barbed wire, through icy streams, and up and down hills, with the men gasping for air. "What's the matter with you guys? I haven't lost my breath," he yelled at his panting troops. A trooper in the back, who Donovan couldn't see, shouted, "Hell, we aren't as wild as you are, Bill." From that moment on, the Wild Bill moniker stuck. Although Donovan professed annoyance with the nickname because it ran counter to the quiet, intense image he wanted to project, his wife said he secretly loved it. Shortly after that, Donovan led 1st Battalion into combat and established a reputation as one who led from the front. He also refused to remove his rank insignia and other identifying features from his uniform when facing the enemy. When others asked if this didn't make him more of a target, he answered, saying that he wanted to make sure that his troops knew where their commander was on the battlefield, that they knew he was exposed to the same dangers that they were, and he could also rally his troops, saying, "They can't hit me, and they can't hit you." As many combat commanders are before seeing combat for the first time, Donovan wondered exactly how he would react when he encountered enemy fire. It did not take long for him to find his answer. In February 1918, he wrote to Ruth that he discovered he had no fear of being able to stand up under fire. He also told her he had grown easily accustomed to Germans shooting at him and he firing back, concluding that he was thrilled by the danger of combat like a youngster at Halloween. While that does boost morale and all, it should not come as a surprise to learn that it didn't take long before he was wounded, taking both shrapnel in his leg and nearly losing his sight after being gassed. While those wounds sound serious, they did not keep him sidelined for long, and he soon found himself in combat again. In another incident, Donovan took the lead in organizing the rescue of French soldiers trapped when their dugout collapsed during an artillery bombardment. He was offered a Croix de Guerre from France for his heroics, but turned it down because a Jewish soldier who had played a key part in the rescue was not also offered the honor because of his faith. Only when that insult was corrected did Donovan finally accept the decoration. Donovan's lead from the front style quickly won him praise from the higher-ups in the 42nd Division headquarters, and he became a legend amongst the soldiers of the Allied Expeditionary Forces, and civilians back home couldn't get enough of his exploits. Ruth was soon retyping selections of his letters home, including vivid descriptions of battle, and passed them on to New York's influential Senator James Wadsworth, who was impressed enough to become Donovan's political mentor. Ruth also sent these selections to the New York newspapers, who eagerly published them. In July, Donovan led 1st Battalion in an assault to push back German infantry during the Aisne-Marne campaign northeast of Paris. That battle's cost to the Irish regiment was staggering. 1,571 killed, wounded, or missing, almost half of the regiment. Donovan lost all of his company commanders, as well as the poet Joyce Kilmer, who had been serving as his adjutant. Today, Kilmer is best known for penning the line, "I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree." General Pershing personally penned a Distinguished Service Cross, the Army's second highest award for valor, on Donovan's chest for the assault. The 1940 James Cagney movie The Fighting 69th dramatized the events of this battle and the regiment's role in it. As you might imagine, receiving explicit, detailed descriptions of her husband's combat operations took a physical toll on Ruth Donovan. She was now also sure he was going to get himself killed, and she was desperately lonely once more. All this plunged her again into bouts of depression. She wanted to travel to Paris to see Donovan when he had leave, but he refused, saying that he already had enough on his mind without worrying that German bombings of the French capital could also endanger his wife. The best Donovan could offer Ruth was pep talks in his letters, praising her for her pluck and suggesting that she take in the sea air and read to ease her anxiety about him. Looking for support from somewhere, Ruth turned to Donovan's younger brothers, Timothy III and Vincent. She had leaned on Timothy during Donovan's time in the Mexican border, but now he was also in Europe with the Army Medical Corps, so this time she turned to Vincent. Friends believe that Donovan's brothers were much better matches for Ruth, so it was unsurprising that unfounded rumors of infidelity began to spread. After the devastating charge that earned Donovan the Distinguished Service Cross, he was promoted from command of 1st Battalion to the Chief of Staff for the entire 165th Regiment. He considered this a choice assignment because he would now be the forward ground commander for the entire regiment for an upcoming battle that everyone knew was on its way. While the competent and low-key commander, Colonel Mitchell, would stay in his dugout in the rear, Donovan would be at the front, leading his men into what he knew would be a meat grinder. This seems like a good place to pause the story for now. On the eve of the battle that would do more to cement the legend and legacy of Wild Bill Donovan than anything else that had, up to this point. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are pictures related to every episode on the website, www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. You can help others learn about the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating and review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death. For the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.